Okay, welcome, dear listeners, to another edition of the Jacobs Podcast. Today we are talking about public versus private. When should government run things? And I'm joined for another episode by Will Witheridge, live from New York. Will, welcome to the Jacobs Podcast.
Hello, Sean. Good to be with you again in 2019. Belated Happy
yes,
New Year.
That's right. Belated Happy New Year. And notably absent from our conversation today, or from the podcast today, is Jordan Shopov, who would typically be joining us on this kind of topic, but he seems to be suffering from a pretty chaotic schedule at the moment, so we do miss him. But what sort of kicked off this thought for me for this podcast was a couple of months ago. Of course, everyone in the UK is talking about Brexit, but Jeremy Corbyn actually recently, a few months ago, put out a call to renationalise the railways after fares went up over 3%. And I think, you know, most millennials or most people will know that the government running things would cost more money. For example, their airfares would be higher, but not too much more, I sense, about why privatization, is much better option for banks, telecommunications, airlines, electricity, and a lot of other sectors. And something we did touch on in the podcast last year, with the sort of year in review, is I think this is going to be a year of, I think, values and capitalism. So I thought on this episode we'd just look at the philosophy behind privatisation, the challenges of the journey, especially in a lot of Western economies since World War II, some of the areas where it doesn't entirely work. I think national defence, although this is an interesting example, and also just the discussion between the government running organisations versus funding services provided by private companies, which seems to be, which is a big trend. One of the things that I sort of noticed, I think, about privatisation and monopolies and cartels forming and the government-owned corporations or the government being heavily involved in industry was when I went up to Papua New Guinea. I'd revisited lots of times over the years when I was younger. And I remember the cost of phone calls, for example, used to be astronomical. And then deregulation of the telecommunications industry happened up there. And so I returned a couple of years later and I noticed everyone had a mobile phone. The cost of calls were much cheaper. People could obviously interact and talk to each other a lot easier. Internet, of course, was also much more readily available. But until previously, the telecommunications sector up there was entirely government run and government owned. And I think that was just a really neat example, I think, of the private enterprise coming in, driving costs down, two companies being created to stoke competition, and then much more people having access to communications. That's just a really textbook example of that. Will, do you have any sort of examples yourself? Or, I mean, it's quite obvious, though, that government has played the government role in the economy has taken a bit of a back seat from what it used to be, I guess, a few decades ago.
Yeah, so if you think back in Australia, the origins of the telecommunications industry were around Telstra, mm-hmm. or Telecom, as it was originally known. And this was establishing the national, you know, telecommunications network in Australia. And you know, as a government-funded and operated organisation, and then that's an example of something which has been privatized in Australia. You know, there's a whole lot more entrance and competitions in the telecommunications sector, and we can also see these benefits of competition and innovation that are encouraged by this. You know, we're speaking here over Skype for free, and other things like WhatsApp. You know, these are just examples of competition and markets really driving down costs for consumers and improving the services which we all have access to now. And you're right in the government playing much less of a role. You know, after the Second World War in countries, you know, in a lot of Western countries, there were big government-run organizations in certain sectors, airline industries, communications, electricity. And a lot of those have been privatized in the last few decades. So yep. Those are some examples which we see in how the how the economy has changed.
Definitely. And one of the other examples as well is airlines too. You know, that was a key thing. I remember back in the sort of early 90s, and flying in Australia used to be extremely expensive. There wasn't much competition, you know, up until the early 90s, there was still the two airlines policy that had functioned since, I believe the 40s, so since World War II. And again, the exact same, you see the same example of, you know, government-owned corporation taking a back seat, competition coming in, a private provider being able to stoke that competition, fares going down, flights becoming much more accessible. So I think these sort of trends are pretty positive. And, you know, you look back as well, and this isn't something that's just very new in economics. I was doing a bit of background sort of reading or a bit of research for this podcast, and you look back to, you know, the 1700s, and Adam Smith was talking about this, and he said, there was a good quote of his, that when crown lands become private, they become well improved and well cultivated. And I think that was just a neat example of how, you know, something, it's not just lower prices, more access, and those sorts of things that we've seen, you know, in across different sectors, but just how better run something can be, and in Smith's language, well improved and better cultivated as well. But, you know, looking at a sort of wider landscape, Willem, you've got a lot of knowledge on, I guess, central banking and, you know, the role of interest rates and markets and those sorts of things. The government did play a pretty large role in the economy more broadly, not just in terms of state-owned enterprises and those sorts of things. Can you just paint a bit of a tiny picture maybe around central banking, which is, I think, just a good example of the government's role, how the government used to play a more of a role in the economy?
Yes, it's an interesting one in that the government in Australia for a long time had the role of setting interest rates and the exchange rate in Australia. These would be fixed and set by the government. Now those now we've moved to a market exchange rate. So that's the Australian dollar is just determined by supply and demand in the foreign exchange market, and the Australian dollar moves freely rather than being set by a cabinet committee, and that being implemented by the Reserve Bank. And you know, so that's now a market mechanism. And on interest rates, this is a slightly different area in which the government has now made interest rate setting, has given that function to an independent body in the Reserve Bank. So it's not exactly privatized, but it's been moved to an independent organization. And I think that's a kind of interesting case. An example which is also interesting about banking is one thing that is a national function is the actual issuance of money, and that the government has a role in issuing and controlling the sort of legal tender of currency in Australia. And this is something which has in countries moved actually in reverse, where they're back hundreds of years ago, there used to be private money issued by private banks. And so there'd be, you know, thinking about it, you know, a Commonwealth Bank of Australia dollar, a NAB dollar. And there was private money issued by different banks. And that led to a lot of instability in the financial system, as, you know, some banks would go bust. And you had this complex system of different private money within a country. And so, you know, we can see a justification for having a single national currency in the benefits of that harmonization across Australia. And so that's, you know, an example of something moving the opposite direction to now being a nationalized.
Yeah, it's interesting. And like you mentioned, the sort of beginning there, how government still plays a role or has smoothed out a lot of regulation for the sake of stability, but government actually still plays a role in terms of its function and setting the interest rate. But market forces tend to be, front and centre, or much more so than, you know, like you mentioned, supply and demand and those sorts of things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the big trend over the past few decades has been towards more market-based mechanism and government, stepping back from its role in, you know, controlling different parts of the economy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think you do see that with, you know, transferring that example of interest rates to private companies or companies that were once nationalised. You do see that it's an exposure to market forces, supply and demand, perhaps, you know, labour practices as well, you know, hiring and firing people, procurement, all of these things that affect a company, you know, can be done, I guess, much more smoothly and much more easily compared to a government run or state-owned enterprise. But, you know, there's still a bit of pushback there, you know, where people, I think, do want some level of, I guess, certainty that, you know, if the government is going to be involved somehow. But more broadly, and I think we'll probably get to that a little bit later, but I just sense that, you know, more broadly in terms of that regulatory regime about, you know, trying to break apart state-owned enterprises, privatisation occurs, then you've still actually got, you know, this capacity for companies to, I guess, monopolise in any industry. And that's something, again, that Adam Smith talked about. And, you know, he said, this is in The Wealth of Nations, to widen the market and to narrow the competition is always in the interest of the dealers. And I think that that is just a really pertinent historical observation that I think can apply to, you know, I guess how things used to be run, for example, in the two airlines policy, how things used to be run in the example I gave at the beginning in the telecommunications industry. So there's always that propensity, I think, for things to monopolise. And I think that's an instinctive thing that people realise isn't a good thing. You know, I touched on at the start of the episode about how people sort of know that, you know, costs go down when a private company can run something versus the government. But that's the other sort of sentiment out there that I think people appreciate or understand, is how if you have, I guess, one company, and it might be a private enterprise, running something without much competition, then that's probably not a good thing in the same sense as the government running something.
Yeah, I'd agree in that there's, you know, you want, part of the reason and justification for privatization is, you know, to use market forces and the power of incentives and competition to improve products and services. But, you know, if there's a lack of competition then in certain sectors, and then that's also harmful. And so, you know, the government has an important role in promoting competition and trying to, you know, and some examples where privatization maybe has gone wrong is when public monopolies have just been privatized, and without promoting adequate competition, then that's led to bad to poor outcomes. So this was mentioned in thinking about the electricity market in Australia, and the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's report on the electricity market. They gave the example of in New South Wales, where government-run electricity providers were privatised, but there wasn't adequate competition ensured. So that's, you know, that's led to you know, part of the reason for high electricity prices in that particular sector. That's, you know, part of the example. So yeah, I'd agree that promoting competition is really where the gains from privatization come from, compared to a government run monopoly in a certain sector.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things, you know, we touched on just before is sort of, yes, the government's sort of taken a just to loop back around on that one, but the government's taken a back seat in a lot of senses. But in a lot of ways, though, that, you know, if the government isn't running something, they certainly play a heavy hand in some senses in terms of regulation. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think, because I pay a lot of attention to political risk, for example, and there's a great book out by Condoleezza Rice and Amy Ziegart from Stanford University that came out late last year. And the sort of thinking on this is, you know, the risk of expropriation or a government taking back an industry is a trend that's, you know, it's not done anymore. Even in play, that used to be the political risk, you know, in the 60s and the 70s. Nationalisation of industries was sort of all in the rage, especially in a lot of developing economies when that sort of prevailing view on economics sort of took hold. But, you know, like, things are much more, I guess, detailed now, or in the sense that, you know, like, some of the, we're not arguing, I sense, about nationalisation occurring, but the level of government regulation and the level of government involvement in regulating a private enterprise. But maybe actually before we even get onto that, it might just be worth, you know, there are some examples of this kind of mix of where if the government doesn't run something, it provides money to a private provider who is much better able to conduct that business, but it's still supported by taxpayer dollars. And you've probably seen some good examples of that throughout your time, Will.
Yeah, so I think there is this mix in some areas where there'll be a either the government funding private operators. So for example, we have government funded and run schools, but we also have, you know, government providing funding to independent, you know, privately run schools at the same time. A different area in thinking about, you know, infrastructure provision is often an area where, you know, the government provision of services is strongly advocated, you know, providing some sort of economic or social benefits from some nationwide network. So, you know, for example, the National Highway Network or the National Rail Network in Australia. Those are government funded. So in thinking about the Australian sort of National Rail Network, these are government funded, you know, by the Australian Rail Track Corporation. This is a state-owned enterprise in Australia. But private rail operators are the ones who actually utilize the track and you know, provide that sort of retail end service. So it's like the government, and this happens in a lot of areas, the government provides the capital cost or something, and then the operations of it is done by a private enterprise or multiple private enterprises which compete against each other.
I promise we'd get back to this, but in terms of how private providers can monopolize in their own sort of way or in their own sense, or deals can still be cut even between private providers and government or two private providers. Will, do you just want to jump in?
I wanted to think about this and where in a lot of this sort of consumer competition areas where in trying to assess whether there's too much power in a certain sector, we've sort of talked a bit about there being sort of big monopoly players in a particular industry and that being harmful. And a different form, which is also harmful or potentially you know, inhibits competition, is when one particular company owns multiple stages. So this is known as a company being sort of vertically integrated. So an example is a company which is an electricity generator and also a retailer. So this is someone which, you know, controls the electricity generation and the retail side in selling to consumers, and that they're often having a lot more market power and compared to, you know, other retailers of electricity. So competition policy often tries to, you know, separate those different stages of the production process from a particular company. And this is, you know, sometimes how government run companies are privatized, is by splitting up these different aspects of the production chain.
Yeah, no, that's a good example of that, you know, just how detailed things are and how, I guess, difficult it is or can be for regulation to sort of counter that monopolistic kind of behaviour. It really is quite tricky from a regulatory standpoint, it seems. Now, you know, I talked about before about what I think, I sense is what might be a nationalisation in new clothes. So when I talked about political risk and the risk of expropriation sort of going out the window, but in the sense that things are becoming so exposure to different kinds of risks, so regulatory risk, supply chain risk, violence, public perception, those sorts of things, you know, are sort of on the ascendance versus all-out nationalisation of an industry. But when you look, for example, at regulatory practice, you do see a lot of, you know, the government being involved. And I remember, you know, from talks I've done last year and giving some really, I think, standout examples of what, you know, red and green tape kind of look like. And some of the examples I cited, for example, the Roy Hill iron ore mine required more than 4,000 licenses, approvals and permits for its just for the construction phase alone. One example I cited, I think previously on the podcast, or if not in a few talks I've given last year, was the Adani Carmichael project. I think has fought off more than maybe 10 legal challenges, and it's had to prepare a 22,000 page environmental impact statement. And but you know, these are before things have even actually started. So, and this kind of gets into, yes, the government's not playing, you know, a role front and centre, but it's, you know, what is the right role for government, you know, in terms of, yes, breaking apart monopolies, but then just finding a balance between burdensome regulation, in this case red and, I guess, green tape, versus running the thing itself. Because it seems that, you know, a lot of that activity is just obviously very stifling, still, even though the government's not playing a key role in terms of running coal mines, which used to be the case.
Yeah, and these are different ways in which the government can try and intervene or not in markets to try and shape outcomes. So, you know, we've been talking about, you know, directly the government running something or providing a service in a particular sector. And there's other, you know, a sort of middle road between complete privatization, free markets, is, you know, the government regulation or taxation in a sector to try and influence outcomes. So yes, this is a different form of government intervention to try and encourage or discourage different types of behavior. So, you know, those are more within a market type mechanism, but yes, is of course still influencing the incentives of market actors in certain ways.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, this sort of goes back to what we were talking about people, I sense, sort of want some level of government involvement still, or in some, you know, way to play, you know, a role in terms of the regulatory regime where it finds a right balance. And I think that's sort of where the debate is now. Is about finding that balance versus the government being just wholesale involved. So I think, you know, it's a different discussion that we're having now. It's much more detailed. I think, yeah, it's a lot different to what, you know, the challenges I think in the 60s and the 70s were for a lot of free market thinkers, or in terms of the challenges just become so difficult to try and regulate, but then also to try and find that balance.
Yeah, another example might be something like, you know, in trying to fund, you know, innovation and scientific research. You know, this is something which, you know, government is often trying to encourage on the justification that it might be, you know, underprovided. Mm. There might be you know, less research and innovation than we would like if the market was left to, you know, purely private actors, because a lot of scientific research has these kind of broader spillover benefits to other sectors, which aren't necessarily intended by the people doing or people doing the research themselves. Mm. So, you know, then we could think about alternatives like the government, you know, setting up some research institution and, you know, directing research that way, or providing a sort of broad subsidy for research and development by private actors to try and encourage that sort of behavior. So the latter is much more using a market-type mechanism to encourage behaviour in a certain way.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that, and just before we came on, we were in Paris recently, and many yellow shirts around, or had they dissipated slightly?
I didn't see too many of the yellow vests. I think the protests had really died down just before I got there. So. Its usual unruly in ways place, but yeah, no more than usual.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I just bring it up because it's an interesting example, I think, because, you know, what they're railing about there, pardon me, is crony capitalism. And, you know, where there's a great article on this, like a sort of really good analysis on this by Pascal Gobry in Commentary magazine. But, you know, he writes that, you know, the word reform, or economic reform, is just most often seen as crony capitalism. You know, like, people did see privatization as desirable, as lots of other people did, again, because of those things that it brings: competition, lower costs, more access, and, you know, things that are more better run and more reliable. But it sort of, within that itself, created this sort of monopolistic kind of cartel-like behaviour. And I'll just read out what he wrote, and I'll put this a link to this article in the show notes because it's a really good analysis. But, and he writes, "Now, certainly some privatisation was desirable, but whatever else it did, it created an extremely lucrative revolving door with senior government officers moving pieces on the economic chessboard, investment banks advising on those same moves, and on the senior management of government-linked companies. This created a unified French managerial class of people who went to the same schools and now rotate between the senior jobs in government and the private sector." So it, again, so I think this is just a clear example of where that monopolistic behaviour has occurred once privatisation has occurred.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of what has sparked the backlash against capitalism is this view of it being a not capitalism, but crony capitalism. And the global financial crisis in some ways made this stark to a lot of people, in that the banks, which were the cause for a lot of the financial disruption, which has affected so many people, they received, you know, taxpayer-funded bailouts. And so this is, you know, getting at these sort of links between between government and the financial system. And that in this way, the losses of these banks were, in a sense, nationalized, and you know, they'd made all these private gains. And so this is, you know, part of, I think, what is sparking the discontent with the current system as it is. And this isn't to say that, you know, nationalizing a whole lot of industries is the best response, but ensuring that there is you know, competition and transparency, and that, you know, monopolies are, you know, broken up and regulated, that's, you know, that's important responses too.
Yep. And again, it comes back to that detail, like how involved should the government be. And there's always, I think, after, you know, big crises like the GFC, big call for, big push for government to be more involved. And again, I don't think it's going to be that, you know, all-out nationalisation will occur, but certainly more, you know, more elements of those sorts of environmental, you know, red and green tape, or the government playing more of an active role in terms of, you know, guiding outcomes, potentially through R&D or, you know, those sorts of things, and investing in human capital, for example. And you're going to get those calls that are sort of going to be pushed through to politicians to do something about this. But yeah, it's just sort of interesting because it loops back to, I think, where we are now is, and we covered this on a previous episode on globalism, about some of the pressures that a lot of governments are under, you know, in terms of automation, competition, you know, high unemployment, and I think just in terms of you know, trade as well, access and it to other markets and what other countries are doing in terms of their trade practices. And you know, I sense that, you know, the horizon for this is going to be you know, kind of an interesting one, where there's governments are under so much pressure to be more involved and intervene, when I sense that we're not going to see that intervention by nationalisation or takeover industries. I don't think we're ever going to go back to that again. But I think, you know, like the pull of government to be more involved is certainly going to become much more salient as sort of time kind of goes on.
Yeah, I agree. There's, you know, the talking about you know, renationalizing industries. That's those are more a small number of extreme voices in these sort of conversations. But there's definitely this this push in many areas for the government to intervene in what people see as a rigged or sort of unfair system. And I think you know, in that there. What we're talking about here is the amount of opportunity which people have, and the kind of dynamism within a society or an economy, in that there's you know, there is competition and that people have an opportunity to advance, and that there isn't a sort of a locked in upper class or oligopolistic a few firms in that dominate a particular industry and that have these close links with government or regulators. That's definitely a strong backlash and requires a different type of response, maybe.
Yeah, and exactly what we've France, I think, is just the textbook example of that. All right, well, I think that's been a pretty decent discussion, Will. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on? Probably one more thing I wanted to just say as well is just, a lot of corporations in themselves or businesses in themselves are so large that sometimes they can be quite unresponsive and even internally monopolistic. And one example of this, and I want to cover this in another episode, is this sort of idea of corporate social responsibility as well. And Dr. Jeremy Sammet at the Center for Independent Studies is doing a lot of good work on this at the moment about, social, in a lot of cases, signaling or virtue signaling by large companies, which sort of go counter to shareholder wishes occurs, but then, the company not being responsive to those. So it goes sort of out of bounds a little bit in terms of advocating for certain social initiatives that aren't sort of core business. Their shareholders get unhappy, people have a stake in the company, but then that company not, redirecting their kind of behaviour. And I guess, that's just an interesting trend to observe too, that it ties back into this idea of that, you can have privatisation, but you're still going to have that sort of monopolistic behaviour or that unresponsive behaviour occur, even within when a company is supposed to be exposed to market forces and sentiment and consumer or stakeholder sentiment, you can still have that kind of behaviour. And I think that's just an interesting trend that we're going to see a lot more of, and you can see it a lot this year. So I'll try to dig up some of Jeremy's work and then post that in the show notes, because I think it's just one of these things that's happening that we're going to see more of.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention a couple of other examples of a model which we is more on the publicly funded state-owned enterprise side, which is not a completely government funded and run organization, but is still owned by the government, but is a pseudo separate organization that achieves certain outcomes. So an example is thinking about is Australia Post. Mm. So this was originally the Postmaster General's department set up to provide postal services around Australia, but is now run as still owned by the government, but is operated as a state-owned enterprise. Mm. And this is the justification being that we want to provide postal services to throughout Australia, and that a private provider alone may not provide the same level of service across the nation. Mm. And so this is where there's this kind of mission for and justification for a national postal service. So I think that's one example of this interesting hybrid. And another one in Australia which is very prominent is the Snowy Hydro scheme. So this is another big national or covering New South Wales and Victoria in electricity generations, a hugely ambitious engineering project. And this is a government funded and run organization, and is again in that category of it's fully owned by the governments of the New South Wales, Victoria, and the Commonwealth, but it's run as a separate entity in which the government is the only shareholder. So I think that's some interesting examples of that kind of hybrid, different to what you were talking about of private organizations which have these sort of broader social objectives or accountabilities. Mm. But yeah, I just wanted to just mention those, another category in this space.
Definitely, and the Snowy always gets cited as the bold, ambitious project, and if you're not, it's you're accused of not being optimistic, and someone who is asked to just all think of the Snowy. I think that was I think just to sort of recap that, I think a lot of the game has changed. We're not going to see, all that nationalisation or a return to the two airlines policy, but I think the governments of all stripes are under a lot of pressure to be actively involved in certain things, especially after crises occur, especially when you're seeing this wave of all these huge trends that are underway at the moment in terms of, massive unemployment and education systems not able to kind of meet the skills or the demand of industries, automation, all these things on the horizon that are putting a lot of pressure on governments. And I just sense as well that, Adam Smith's observations ring pretty true in terms of that cartel-like behavior or monopolistic practices performing. That will happen in any, you can see it in any industry, in any sector, at any level, about that kind of behavior to occur, because it's just a natural occurrence, according to Smith. But so that's going to be, that is another factor, I think, to think about, as much as these big trends are shaping the sort of economic world that we live in. There's also this sort of more human traits as well that are kind of calling, that will always be calling for some sort of form or balance of regulation, and how you do that is just going to be that age-old discussion between free enterprise and the role of government.
Yeah, absolutely, and part of what makes Adam Smith so timeless is really thinking about these human aspects and how people respond to incentives and the impact that has on organizations. So yeah, absolutely agree.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much for joining us on this episode, Will. We had to step in and talk about Adam Smith for a bit because Jordan Shopoff didn't join us, but
he'll be jealous.
He will. But I'll throw those links I mentioned in the show notes for listeners, and anything else, any other material as well, we'll send my way, and we'll drop those in as well. And just a reminder to listeners as well, whatever medium that you listen to, please rate the podcast or share it with your friends. Getting some really good coverage now this year on a lot of different platforms, on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Pocket Cast and a few other mediums as well. So please rate it and share with your friends as well. And please get in touch with me for ideas for future discussions. I know agriculture has been flagged by one listener to me to have a look at, and it's something I'm very keen to take a look at on the podcast. And any other ideas for future episodes, go to seanjacobs.com.au. Will, thanks very much for joining us again from New York. Really appreciate you taking the time.
Great. Really enjoyed the discussion and looking forward to the next time.
Sounds good.
All right. See you, Sean.